Taking Stock with Susan Hayes-Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, what if remote working, not AI, is to blame for what's now being called career ladder erosion? How close are we really to a future where cars drive themselves? And what are the opportunities for Ireland and the risks? Plus, three of the most valuable private companies in the world could soon make their stock market debut. But can the market absorb companies of that scale? You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now, I want to start off by explaining to you what valuation metrics are, as all week we've been seeing that markets have been hitting higher highs, and with all the talk about the upcoming IPOs that I mentioned, valuation metrics are often used as a lens to make sense of it. So first of all, a valuation metric is simply a number that measures how valuable a company is. And a lot of the time we use relative valuation metrics. And that basically means that rather than try to work out how much a company's stock is worth, we compare one number to another. And we do that for lots of companies. So then we can pick out who is most under or overvalued. So as an example, the PE ratio is the price to earnings ratio. That's a valuation metric. And it's a simple price versus profit check. So it just shows how much investors are willing to pay for every euro of the company's annual profit. And of course, it would be per dollar if it was in the States or per pound if it was in the UK, etc. So the higher the PE, the more people are willing to pay for a company's profits. But of course, then the higher the risk is that the stock could be overvalued. But for an IPO, for an initial public offering, people compare the PE to similar public companies to factor in how fast the company is growing its profits. But if profits are low or jumpy or negative because the company's in a loss, then the PE isn't very helpful at all. So IPO pricing often focuses more on the PS ratio, or the price to sales ratio, and how the company plans to turn sales into profit. Now, I'm going to be delving further into this today, but I think you're going to be hearing a lot around valuation metrics in the week and weeks ahead as we see the SpaceX IPO come to life. So watch this space. Now, if you were a recent graduate looking to take that first step on the career ladder, what or who might be the thing that would put that career choice on hold? In the tech sector, many of us think AI will do the tasks associated with entry-level employees. And while this might be true in some jobs, it's not the full picture. Now, I came across a paper from the London School of Economics published last week, and that concludes that it's remote working rather than AI might be the culprit. The question is, how true is that in our own labour market? I'm joined now by Larissa Feeney, who is CEO of Kinnor Finance and Business Services. And most recently, she's also the Image CEO of the Year. Larissa, you've made the very clear decision to have a remote native or remote first company. What led you to make that decision, first of all?
Yes, we made a decision to remain remote first, or intentionally remote. And we made that decision not long after the pandemic. You might remember there was a very robust discussion about returning to the office and whether companies should return to the office. And at that time, I decided we were going to remain remote first.
And was it because what was going on as the business restructured during COVID that it really worked? Or was it due to where you wanted to hire from? Was it in response to what staff wanted? I get the timing of it, Larissa, for sure. But what led to the decision being embedded into the company long after COVID was in Ireland?
So we were remote before COVID, but we weren't 100% fully remote. I hired my first remote team member about 9 years ago. Remote was very much part of our culture anyway. But what I found, Susan, was after the pandemic, that discussion created a lot of indecision within the company and a lot of uncertainty within the company around our future direction and how would we grow, and would we grow in one location or in multiple locations? Would it be like a hub model? And I felt that we were very effective remotely and we were very productive remotely, and the company had grown strongly up until that point. And I felt if we picked remote And it could have been pick a remote or pick in person, because there's consequences of both. And there's consequences of hybrid too, of course. But I felt that remote was right for us. It gave us access to the right talent nationwide. And that suited us, and we needed access to that talent. And we were serving clients nationwide as well, Susan. So that was a huge part of my decision. And that's why we chose remote.
Okay, well, if we follow on from that, then the paper that I referenced there in my introduction, it's called The Broken Ladder, AI Remote Work and Early Career Hiring. And there's a quote in there that I'd just like your reaction to. It says, work from home has been shown to raise the cost of supervising and monitoring workers and can slow on-the-job learning. What's been your experience?
I've always experienced, I've always had a very positive experience of training remotely, both from the trainee side and the trainer side. What I've said publicly in the past and internally is that if we do see challenges, it's usually the trainer have to be equipped to train. The trainee is usually very open to training remotely, but if there's problems, it's generally on the trainer side. However, what I would say is that we have certainly reduced the number of trainees that we bring on board every year. And this year is the first year that we're actually not hiring any trainees, any trainee accountants, which is the first year ever in the history of the company.
Why is that, Alyssa?
Well, it's because, Susan, what I have learned about remote working in general, everything that we do within the company have to be intentional. And in the past, we might have had a policy around hiring a certain number of trainee accountants on an annual basis to make sure we had a pipeline for future skilled, qualified professionals. But whenever we sat down and looked at it and looked at the numbers, and yes, there's a role of AI, and yes, there's a role of remote working, we don't have to hire a certain amount on an annual basis. We do need to hire, but not X amount and not every year.
So if you don't hire people at an early stage, and as you say, that's the choice that you made this year, but how, and I'm taking your own word here, how can you intentionally then cultivate that early mid-management talent pipeline? Is it looking at this from maybe a three-year point of view, or is it thinking about, well, we're not quite sure what the skills of tomorrow will need? How are you intending to be intentional when the time comes?
We have the benefit, I suppose, of, because if we're talking about trainee accountants, in my world, it generally is trainee accountants, we have a three-year timeline. So we have, the young professionals come into us usually as graduates, sometimes as school leavers, and will train with us for 3 years and then qualify, all going well for them. So we have 3 years that we can plan, so we can look 3 years ahead. So we just have to make sure that we have enough talent in the pipeline to fill that qualified level, that newly qualified level in 3 years' time. So that, in our case this year, means that we don't have to hire because we have enough in the pipeline already. But that's not going to be the case every year.
You mentioned there that you take on school leavers. Is that in the context then of an apprenticeship so that they would go on to be accountants? Is that the way it works?
Yeah.
Or would it be for non-technical roles?
Both actually. If we're talking about technical roles, you're talking about an accounting technician path. So that would be a pathway where the student would be working sometimes 4 days a week and then in college on the fifth day, or working full-time and in college in the evening time. But then for non-technical roles, like client service roles, for example, operations roles, they're also open to school leavers.
Because I don't know if I was interviewing somebody from one of the big four today, Larissa, and I don't know because I don't know, that they would be also having a policy around school leavers. Is that a way you have differentiated yourself in the market, or how has that come about?
That actually wasn't an intentional decision. And I suppose, Susan, what the attitude I take is that I have to be open to every pathway. And that is one of a few pathways that's open to us in terms of developing future talent. And the challenge for us as a remote team is that if school leavers are obviously not as experienced or developed as graduates are, so it's just the added complexity of ensuring that they're working well remotely that does make it more difficult for us in that area.
And that does bring us back then to the point that I had raised a couple of minutes ago around work from home showing to raise that cost. But again, if you're intentional, and as you say, the trainer needs to be equipped to do it. There's a second quote that I'd like to take out of the paper and put to you, and that is this. Is generative AI replacing junior workers? A growing literature answers yes, citing large declines in early stage hiring concentrated in Gen AI exposed occupations. The paper argues, however, this verdict is premature because Gen AI exposure is strongly correlated with another post-pandemic shock, namely working from home. In other words, it makes the point that we conflate the reason that fewer people are taken on is because we think it is down to AI, but it's actually because they're simply harder to manage in a work from home scenario. And therefore, we are taking on fewer people for that reason. What do you think?
I think it's a balance of the two. I think that what I have seen in this sector is a gradual increase in automation of manual tasks over time, which means that there's less of that work for the junior or for the trainee. So that element, you know, and you can call that AI, and some of it is and some of it is not, that has led to a reduction in the need for those graduate entrants in this particular sector. And for us, add to that the complexity of remote training or the risks around remote training and how careful we have to be with that means that we're a bit more careful when we hire. However, I would add something else to it, Susan. And that is in this particular sector. So I'm talking about my own, which is accounting. The same probably applies to professional services in general. If I can look to the US, there's loads of data on the US in this. The average qualified accountant in the US is almost 6 years of age. Most accountants are past retirement age. And entrants to the sector are declining year on year. In 2025, entrants declined by almost 17%. So you have less of a talent pool, and then you add to that the impact of AI and the impact of remote working. And you can see, first of all, how difficult it is for firms to find the right talent. And then are they balancing that out with increasing investment in technology so that they can increase capabilities around AI? And obviously, remote working plays a part of that.
Ah, so you're actually dealing with an external factor as well, which is that fewer people are going into the profession in the first place.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. That's what the data would suggest.
Is there also a question around the skill set of an accountant, whereby they are very transferable skills? And now I saw last year in 2025 was the first time that the Big Four sought out more AI experts than auditors in terms of their recruitment. Now, obviously, that is who they were recruiting last year is distinct to the composition of the workforce that's there. But is it now the case that the skills that are needed in order to be a successful, I'm going to say accountant, but I feel that that's not even the correct term, because in some cases they also need to be salespeople. In some cases they need to be AI literate, etc. Is it that the skills in demand today are also now in demand by plenty of other sectors too? And therefore, there is, while there might be more fewer people going into the profession, more people are looking for the skills that they will get through their training.
Yes, exactly. That the skills that they will get, regardless of the degree that you've come from, Sue. So even if you take my own case, with a degree in hospitality management and having become a qualified accountant, that has given that foundation gave me huge skills in an area like customer service, which has given me a firm advantage in the years since in growing the business. And that applies to graduates today. So yes, your degree could be in any area. What the professional qualification gives you is a level of understanding and knowledge of business and a huge amount of trust between the business and the professional. I think chartered accountants, qualified accountants are something like the second most trusted profession globally. So it gives you a huge amount of professional ability and professional awareness and commercial awareness that other professions don't have the benefit of.
And, you know, simply the language of finance as well. That is a universal language for sure. Larissa, as I was preparing for today, it did get me thinking just about how the workplace has changed in decades. And when I think about, and I'm being very broad in my trends now, but we now, let's say, have an always-on culture. We now have different expectations even around socialising, whether it's with clients or with other people. Work from home isn't as conducive to, you know, drinks on a Thursday night, let's say. We've shifted away from authoritarian ways of leadership into more bringing people with you. There's more design or flexibility to design your working day. There's a relaxation of a dress code. And when we put all of this together, it did make me think, have we made changes in our workplace design that have benefited one generation of workers over another, do you think?
Yes, I do. I think that what we have done is we have made changes in the workplace to benefit a generation of workers that is suited to work from home. And we may be doing that to the detriment of a future generation. And I do worry about that. I know for us internally, that's why we have to be so intentional around in-person meetups, around get-togethers, around cross-collaboration in terms of projects. And it's very, very difficult remotely, Susan. So, and companies do have to put a huge amount of effort into that. And that's why remote working is so hard, because you don't have to do that in person. But I do agree with you that I wonder, are we sacrificing something in the future of business and the future of personal development for the younger generation?
What do you say, Larissa, to those who would challenge leaders like yourself that says, well, you're saving a fortune on having people work from home because then you don't have to pay for the rental of or the ownership of any property to put them in? What would you say to that?
The advice I got at the time, whenever I made the decision to be intentionally remote first, the very, very sound advice I got at the time that I followed since is any money that you save on rent or having people in offices, you put into bringing people together. And that's exactly what we've done. So there's been zero saving to the bottom line from the remote working perspective within Kinnor because of that policy that we have. We're constantly bringing people together and we constantly work to build relationships. You could also say from an AI perspective, Susan, that, you know, we should be seeing productivity gains in AI, right? Which also, you know, that if that is investment in AI results in reduced hiring at graduate level, we should see an impact on margin and profit, right? And we're not really seeing that yet. What we see in productivity gains, we don't see in profitability gains, which is really interesting. And I think that's because firms are investing a huge amount in this area right now. And maybe that's something that we'll see in the future.
I've one last question and I'm going to ask your permission to ask it to you, actually, because ordinarily I don't, but in this case I will. You're quite reflective on your own social media, Larissa, and I know that you have a son doing the Leaving Cert this year because you've been talking about this on your social media. Has our conversation today shaped or been shaped by the fact that you're a mother of a teenager going into this world?
Yes, and I'm also the mother of a 20-year-old as well who is in university. And so my current thought process and opinion on this is very much impacted by my worry over their progress through their career and their own personal development. And where will they go and what are the paths that are open to them? If we're shifting toward the remote model, and I say that as a CEO of a remote company, right, which I think the remote model is very much right for Kinnor. Is it right for everybody, though? And I think what I would advocate for is an in-person model is not right for everybody, and a remote model is not right for everybody. But for my kids, for example, I'll be advising them on what I think is right for their personality and for their development. But what I do notice about a remote working environment, Susan, is that there's personalities that thrive in a remote world that don't thrive in an in-person world.
We'll leave it there, Larissa, but I'm delighted that I got the chance to go full circle with you because, as you say, certain personalities are conducive to it, certain work environments are conducive to it, and certain companies are. That's not to say all are. Really appreciate your time today. Larissa Feeney, CEO of Kinnor Finance and Business Services, and more recently, Image CEO of the Year. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, just how significant would SpaceX, Anthropic and OpenAI IPOs be relative to previous blockbuster listings? You're very welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for this week's trivia, I have a tough one for you. Well, I have a tough one for you every week or so. I try to make them anyway. Where in the world, more specifically, where on Earth, might I find the longest mountain range, 37 critical minerals and the world's largest living structure? Have a think and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, three of the most valuable private companies in the world could soon make their stock market debut. SpaceX is reportedly preparing a massive IPO, which will soon be coming to the markets this week. while AI giants Anthropic and OpenAI are expected to follow. Now, together, they could add trillions of dollars to the value of public traded companies and potentially become some of the biggest listings in financial history. But the question really is, can the market absorb companies of that scale? And what happens if they're fast-tracked into major indices like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100? And could passive investors find themselves buying these stocks really, whether they want to or not? So to discuss it all, I'm joined by Ronan Reid, Non-Executive Director of the Cantor Fitzgerald Ireland Group. Okay, Ronan, first off, the current record for capital raised by a debut listing is held by Saudi Aramco.
Yep.
In 2019, it garnered $29 billion, let's say $38 billion in today's money when it floated in Riyadh. Just how significant is SpaceX, Anthropic and OpenAI in comparison?
Well, both need to raise money. I mean, it's like science fiction reading SpaceX. I mean, what's the money going to be used for? It's going to be used to build the largest rocket ever seen, reusable rocket to launch. Building out Starlink, which is how phones, Starlink is a satellite network that's much closer to the Earth than the old positioning ones. And then obviously its foray into AI, further forays. It has X and it has Grok and a bunch of other companies and has talked about acquisitions in the space. So the raising, it's significant and they'll come into the index, probably ranking behind the top five when they eventually do. The top five being all tech companies in their own right, who are all customers of each other.
Okay, but let's go back, not just to understand the business, but the numbers behind the business, because the XAI division of SpaceX, we'll say what will become SpaceX, it made a loss of $6.4 billion in 2025, but the prospectus says it has a TAM, or a total addressable market, of $26.5 trillion, and there's a $2 trillion total addressable market for the Starlink internet service and space operation. So it's not making any profit. It is making money. And is the whole idea here that it sells the dream to investors that it could make loads and loads and loads and loads more?
It is. And the first two businesses, the one that launches satellites and the one that controls Starlink, the satellites, are highly... The current satellite business is very profitable, and I suspect the launch business will be very profitable. Governments haven't been effective, and what they're raising money in part is something that effectively brings down the cost of putting every kilogram from whatever it is, $3,000 to $1,000 to build one of the largest spaceships. So they're successful. The AI part is much harder to figure, and you wonder if they're rushing out to get out ahead of OpenAI and Anthropic, who both come to the market simultaneously as well, or are rumored to be coming to the market simultaneously. But it's losing. I mean, its losses are predominantly arising out of AI. It's estimated around $5 billion a year it's losing on AI.
And so Goldman Sachs, a piece of breaking news came out on Thursday afternoon, I believe, that Goldman Sachs, now it's the lead investment bank for the IPO, they believe that the SpaceX's AI revenue could serve 100 times by 2030. Does IPO also stand for it's probably overpriced?
I think it could be, certainly. And it was interesting, other parts of Goldman Sachs talked down the market because they saw the draw that this is going to have on liquidity. And as you mentioned earlier, passive funds could end up buying it because they are being fast-tracked into the index. You used to have to trade for a year or whatever it was for a period of time, and then you'd be allowed into the index. Now there's fast-tracking into the index. And a market has radically changed from times when you would invest to get a spread of securities, dividend income and other things, to essentially five stocks. I mean, it'll be lower capitalized than the other five stocks straight away, like everything from Nvidia, which I think is about $6 billion, all the way down to Amazon at number five. I think it's Amazon at number five, or Alphabet, which are about $2 billion. So people are estimating the market cap of it'll be about $2 trillion.
Right, but there's a difference between market cap and free float.
Yeah.
And at the risk of getting technical here, can you differentiate the difference between the two of them?
They're very simple. What's the overall value of the company, and then how many shares are in existence that you can trade? So its free float will be small, the amount it can trade, that can be tradable, or the amount of shares released. And yet, its market cap is what contributes to the index. It gets adjusted, but it contributes to the index. So if it ranks in the top 10 stocks, passive funds will have to buy that amount of the index, and there's less supply, so it'll drive up the value. There are no sellers. the only sellers, I suspect, into the IPO will be those that invested in the last round, all the private equity players and all the others, all the other insiders who will sell to the public, and passive funds will chase it up. It's reckoned that they'll need to buy about 20 billion of stock.
But when you say the insiders, I mean, they were the people who took the most risk at the beginning too, I would argue.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are, well, some of them aren't there at the beginning. People are always surprised. They think Starlink is a recent invention. I mean, Starlink's around since 2003, and they do control and have made serious inroads into the launching of satellites and the control of satellites. And that's where the profitability, it's a near monopoly position on the lower range of satellites that Musk and SpaceX have.
If I go 10 years earlier than your 2003 point, if we go back to 1993, Ronan, that was when the S&P 500 ETF, the SPY, as we now know it, came to be. And I remember, like, when I was training to be a CFA or a chartered financial analyst, the whole idea of passive investing or investing into an exchange traded fund like the S&P 500 was diversification. If you invested into the S&P 500, 500 different stocks. But are we now at a risk of where there is so much concentration in one industry that a passive investor now has to make active decisions in order to get passive again?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a fair comment. I think there were two trends. One was diversification. The other one was cost. People wanted to pay lower and lower management fees. So exchange traded funds became the norm, and passive investing where investment managers didn't have to pay people to actively manage or trade. It just followed an index each day, as a result of which ETFs were able to charge management fees that were maybe one-tenth of what it was for fund managers to do, or more active fund managers. So people can end up, and it was the same last year, the Magnificent Seven, that really determined the performance of your funds. So there are some ETFs created that exclude some of these stocks, but again, they're not huge. And the tax position isn't always great. But I think the answer is people will end up with an exposure one way or the other. Yeah.
Okay. But if there is going to be ETFs or private investors or whatever, if the, as the three IPOs happen, and let's just take SpaceX in the first place, for those buyers to come to the table, do you think they will be selling other positions, or do you think this is capital that is going to be new to the market?
Well, they're selling shares. There's some existing, the insiders will provide some shares and the company will raise money. I think at the end of this, SpaceX will nearly have 100 billion. It's raising about 60 billion. That's fresh capital. That's new shares. And then insiders will make up a lot of the excess demand, I expect, on the other side, which is the likes of index funds. And they're not just ETFs. I mean, if you took, I think in Ireland, the largest asset manager is Irish Life, a large percentage of its funds will be passive funds. So it's generally, it has become the norm in markets as such. So I would imagine that insiders will provide that secondary liquidity and sell some of their shares. And new money's raised is around the level of around 60 billion is what's rumoured now.
But if I was to follow that thread then, if it's going to raise 60 billion, where is that 60 billion going to come from? Is it funds like, as you say, Irish Life or other passive funds? Are they going to have to trim their positions in other tech stocks?
Yep.
Are you expecting share prices to fall of the Mag 7 as a result, including, ironically, Tesla?
Yeah, ironically, Tesla. But the amount of money raised, I mean, for context, the S&P index is 68 trillion in value. So it'll have some impact, but not a massive impact. I mean, the appreciation of stock markets over the last 10 or 15 years has been enormous. So that's 68 trillion. And I think the top four or five tech stocks account for about 25% of the indexes. So there'll be some impact in terms of liquidity and markets moving around, but I don't expect it to be excessive. The issue, I think, is a broader issue in AI, which is that a lot of the revenue numbers talked about, the annual recurring revenues and others, are all some of the tech companies trading between themselves. Somebody might buy equipment from NVIDIA, and NVIDIA might buy other services from the other tech companies. It's the nature of it. And there won't be like multiple winners. Eventually somebody wins out. So there's massive investment going into AI. Whether it all generates a return over time will be interesting to see.
Well, what do you think of so far? Because there was a big criticism, particularly last year, I would say, around is AI in a bubble? But yet, like, we're almost through earnings season now for Q2. The reality is an awful lot of these companies are delivering actual revenue, in contrast to back in 1999 and 2000, when companies were buying and selling things from each other, but no money was really transferring hands. So is there, could we question that or challenge the assumption that was being made last year, then are we seeing returns?
Well, I think when you still look at it in terms of broader participation, there isn't a broader impact on the economy. If it was really impacting and there was broad usage of AI, we would have more, like, you know, job losses and other things, because that's what AI does. Like, you know, it effectively automates activities. There hasn't been the same extent of it. And I think people are still struggling to see how much real underlying demand. There's no doubt it is going to radically change the way economies work, the way businesses work, no doubt whatsoever. Whether it justifies the level of investment is, for me, is a pretty big open question. And you have a lot of big companies now chasing it. And I think the example you gave at the start was interesting in Aramco. It was an oil company, the Saudi oil company. Who would have thought the Saudis had to raise money when the amount of oil they have? And now we have the tech companies. And the reason why they were loved and the Mag 7 worked is because they were so profitable and throwing off so much cash. And now they're investing, and they're investing beyond the cash they generate, and they're raising huge amounts of money. And when you look at, I think it's Anthropic, the two largest shareholders, some of the largest shareholders are definitely Google and definitely Microsoft, who are pumping money into it as well. So I don't believe the annual, when you look at the metrics, I saw a comment, someone saying, hey, they're only coming at software values. They're coming at massively inflated. Traditionally, software values at the extreme was 5 times revenue. This is multiples and multiples of that. And eventually, markets always normalize. Like, you know, either share prices come down or earnings go up. Mm-hmm. That's the way it works. And I can't yet see the demand. And the flip side of that that people haven't learned is, if they were all winners, then there'd be less people working. Then there's less revenue, then there's less other side to it. So I think it's somewhere in between that is where it comes down, and there will be winners and losers. You could see that Jeff Bezos tried to challenge SpaceX on the launch. Didn't work. Like, you know, so things get burnt up quite quickly. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in terms of the absolute level of capital investment.
What do you think about the fact that the three companies we're talking about are going down the equity route, but several of the Mag 7 are going down the debt route? They're raising money from the bond market in order to fund their investment in the infrastructure. Is there anything you read into that?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, we've already seen constraints. Private credit markets have tightened up. Interest rates are higher. I'm surprised, because this is high risk, as what you said earlier, and you raise equity for high risk. You don't raise debt. And interest rates are an awful lot higher. And on a bad day for Trump politics, you can have interest rates, five-year U.S. Treasury yields have hit some of their highest that they've seen. Gold has been a high price. So that's a nervous time to raise money in debt markets. Very nervous when you don't have predictable cash flows at the end of the day.
Well, it's been intriguing to talk to you, Ronan, and it'll be very interesting to watch what happens Thursday and Friday and September and October. And it'll be, when we get to the end of the year, what the 2026 stories really will be. Thank you very much for joining me here in studio. Ronan Reid, Non-Executive Director of the Cantor Fitzgerald Ireland Group. This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, the government is developing a national strategy to prepare for autonomous vehicles on our roads. But what will that future look like? What are the risks? And what are the possible opportunities? Come back to us. This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Now, driverless taxis are already paying passengers in cities like San Francisco, Phoenix, Arizona, and parts of China. Tesla is pushing ahead with its robo-taxi ambitions, and Waymo is expanding across the United States. And here in Ireland, the government is developing a national strategy to prepare for autonomous vehicles on our roads. But how close are we really to a future where cars can drive themselves? And what are the opportunities for Ireland, but also what are the risks? So to discuss this, I'm joined by Russell Vickers, co-founder and CEO of Future Mobility Campus Ireland. First off, Russell, can you tell us, how do you prepare a car to drive autonomously?
Essentially, you need to build a robot that does all the functions that a human does. So you essentially, you need a lot of sensors to be able to replicate what we can see with our eyes. So you need those sensors to work in all types of weather conditions. So not just cameras, you need things like LiDAR and radar. And then once you get all of that sensor information all from all around the vehicle of what's happening, you need to then you have a big supercomputer or a brain that's essentially trying to work out what to do with that information, how to follow the road, how to avoid pedestrians, and, you know, how to follow the rules of the road, essentially. And then from there, it should be able to drive itself.
And who decides when that is? Is there legislation and regulation around that? Or is it a company says, we now want to road test this in real market, real world environments, and then needs permission to do that? Like, who decides that?
Yeah, so the way, because, you know, this is obviously a new technology, so it mostly started in California, and it rolled out on a kind of on a basis of it's up to the companies to prove that the vehicles are safe on the road. So, you know, initially they would have a trained safety driver behind the wheel that could take charge at any moment in time. And then as those vehicles then prove their capabilities over thousands and thousands of miles, then they allowed the safety driver to be fully removed from the vehicle so that, you know, there was essentially no one driving. And it, that's the way most countries are following, you know, that they're following that procedure. They want to do baby steps first. And then when they know that they can trust the companies and the technology, they'll look to roll that out on a larger basis.
So how far away do you think we are from having entirely driverless cars driving the roads of Ireland?
So the main thing for us at the moment, and this is what the Department of Transport is working on, is this strategy of connected autonomous vehicles. Because from a legislation point of view, you know, what the laws in Ireland have been designed around a human behind the wheel. So only recently the legislation was changed to allow what we call level 2 or level 2 plus driving in Ireland, which is essentially, if you think about some of the features that are offered on vehicles such as a Tesla at the moment, which is their full self-drive supervised mode, which essentially means you can, in certain scenarios, you can take your feet off the pedals and your hand off the wheel, but you must be in control of being able to take over at any time. So that's now legal in Ireland, provided the vehicle meets the criteria of that in terms of certification. But what we don't have yet in Ireland is the ability for vehicles with no driver in the loop, like you see in Waymo, with the Waymo vehicles in San Francisco. That's not legal yet in Ireland.
And when do you think it will?
I hope that that's going to be in pretty soon, like in the next couple of years, let's say. And the reason, like, that's, you know, we have to do that is not just because maybe Ireland's a bit behind, but Europe as a whole is way behind on this. This is in China and in the US, in a lot of cities, this is a solved problem. You know, people have an app and they're already getting in these vehicles. So Europe is really trying to accelerate their push towards this to remain competitive. And Ireland will have to do its part to help, you know, to be in the race as well.
When we get down to the business model of robotaxi, I would imagine because you don't have a driver, human driver in a robotaxi, then the journey cost would be cheaper, let's say, than an Uber or than a taxi fare, would it?
Yeah, that's what kind of led the likes of Uber to, you know, push aggressively into autonomous vehicles about 10 years ago. And that's what the Waymo business model. Waymo spent billions of dollars to make the vehicles, improve the technology. But once, from an operating cost point of view, you know, it did, obviously the highest, except for the cost of the vehicle, the next highest cost is then having to pay the driver. So by them removing that cost, then they're able to, you know, justify it. And then, of course, the vehicle doesn't get tired. You know, it doesn't have a certain amount of hours that it can work. It can work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's the business model element of it. But then, of course, from a European point of view, how does that fit in with the regulatory environment that we have? And that's another problem thing we've got to think about.
You mentioned that we may have the legislation for level 4 in Ireland in the next couple of years. I want to jump well past that for a moment and see if this future that I'm about to paint is visible to you. In 2025, there was 2.5 million private cars that were licensed, and 617,814 of those were in Dublin. So around about 1 in 4-ish. Do you think if we had loads of robotaxis, ubiquitous availability at a lower cost than a taxi, a human-driven taxi, do you see dramatic car ownership dropping in, let's say, in Dublin for a start, or in any rural urban environment first, before we get to a carless future or a human-driven carless future?
In that scenario that you've described, it would be a no-brainer. It would be, you know, why would you buy a vehicle that, you know, sits on your driveway 23 hours a day and depreciates by thousands of euros per year? It just would be a no-brainer. You would just subscribe to a service. And it's going to be, you know, you've got to think about it from this point of view. Like, you know, my kids, for example, they might not want to take their driving test, or they might not need to do that because these services will be ubiquitous. Now, that's in, I could see that happening in somewhere like Dublin, but then, you know, in rural Ireland, for example, it's a trickier situation. The road network isn't as good, isn't as developed, and then can these vehicles cope with those conditions? So again, it mightn't be this panacea straight away, but for a lot of people, they will just simply subscribe to a service, and that will be it.
And then what happens next? Because if we think about that and the possible unintended consequence of that, like what about, say, the infrastructure of petrol stations or big car parks around shopping centres, or like we've built the country for fossil fuel powered cars and significant car ownership, between one and two people owning them per household. Do you see an awful lot of unravelling of that, or will we have to think about repurposing that infrastructure? What's happened in California, for example?
Yeah, in California, look, nothing to that extent has happened. But from a city planner point of view, you can really think about, well, I don't need parking spaces, so I can open those up more for cycleways. And, you know, the roads can be narrower just because of these vehicles are going to be there. But then you have another effect, and you do see this in California, where you have these robo-taxis kind of loitering around the place because they're just basically waiting to be called for business. So on the downtimes or on the lower demand times, then those vehicles have to, they either just keep driving around, occupying street, you know, the creating traffic, or do they go to some sort of depot and they park there and then they wait to be called. So that's still getting worked out. And of course, then the other problem with them being truly autonomous is then there's a whole element around keeping those vehicles clean, all of those types of pieces. And how do the vehicle, you know, if someone, got that vehicle on a Saturday night and maybe they weren't feeling too well, and then how do you maybe have to clean up that vehicle after they've been in that, and how does that, you know, for the next customer? So there's a whole element about that hasn't really, it's just starting to be tackled now.
I also think the role of the car could change as well. I mean, maybe I want a remote office and I can't, maybe a hotel foyer is too noisy or a thing like that. You could just, again, assuming that the cost of this would fall significantly enough. I think when I was preparing for today, it really got me thinking about all of the secondary and the third order effects of this. It really could change a lot of things that we take for granted, including, as you say, the ability to learn how to drive. Maybe we won't need that anymore because a piece of technology can do it for us. However, I'm sure there's people listening to me saying, Susan, hold your horses there now and come back to the present. Because I also have to ask, how safe are robo-taxis as we know them today, and particularly through the lens of, say, accidents?
Yeah, so that's the number one concern for people. It's the same way, you know, no one was comfortable with the idea of getting into, well, not many people are comfortable with the idea of getting to a fully automated airplane, for example. So safety is a big concern, but out of the, you know, nearly millions of miles that Waymo have driven at this point, there's been, like, statistically, it's way less accidents than would be when human drivers are involved. The problem with human drivers are, you know, we get distracted, we've got our phones, we're feeling tired, all of these problems, and they lead to a large majority of accidents on our road network. These vehicles they don't have that problem. Now, that's not to say that a vehicle can, you know, that a mistake can be made or it can misinterpret something. That has happened and it does happen. But statistically, it should reduce, you know, road fatalities in a big way. And even when there are accidents, there was a case in California just in the last year or so, and actually one of the robo-taxis actually was going past a school area and a child was hit with that vehicle. But the vehicle, the child, you know, kind of came out from a blind spot or whatever behind a van and then just ran in front of the vehicle, which can happen to anyone. But the vehicle actually reacted far faster than a human driver would. And actually, in that case, the pedestrian was only hit at a few kilometers an hour. So a much lesser effect on the pedestrian than could have happened if there was a human in the loop.
I'm wondering as well, as we're talking here, if we extrapolate this beyond the person getting into a taxi, let's say, as you say, going home on a Saturday night or on the way into work or on the way to the airport, could this then change all sorts of paid driving? So whether that might be delivery, whether that might be public transport, could this change everything in terms of how people get from A to B and goods and freight as well?
Yeah, wherever there's a shortage of drivers, that's where companies are focusing on a business model. And that's it's not an Ireland only thing. This is across the globe in trucking and in different areas in public transport. There's just a shortage of people to be able to do those jobs. And that's where, that's where those services are required. Now, I've started to think about this a little bit, because if you think about the effects of AI and how it possibly replaces, like, you know, software developers and all these kind of these jobs that we're kind of worried about, and it's more about the physical work that we think is going to be the role for humans, more like, you know, sort of hands-on labor. Maybe the humans are going to be wanting to be back in these vehicles rather than, because their jobs could have been displaced by, you know, the software developers are no longer required and things like that. It's very, you could take this in a lot of different ways, but essentially at the moment, you know, it is trying to address a problem where there's just a driver shortage generally, and that this is, you know, the business model makes sense.
You mentioned in the US and China, this is a problem solved. Well, particularly in the context of the areas that you were speaking about there, like Phoenix and San Francisco. What is it about the roads in those cities that makes it conducive for this type of technology? And maybe it is the environment around the legal and the regulatory side of things as well. But why is it there? And as you said earlier, Europe is lagging behind. Is it anything to do with our roads?
Our road network is pretty good from a European context. It started in California because that's where the people were, you know, that could understand these systems, let's say, and, you know, that's where the talent pool was. Then what also lent itself to that was, you know, the weather is a lot better, and the road network is kind of a grid network. So from trying to train a vehicle or train a robot to understand that system, it's an easier system than putting them, say, in center of Galway in a medieval city and they're trying to work out all these road networks. But at this point, those vehicles could still are very capable of still traversing all of those cities. Now, weather is a problem, right? You know, like if you consider the sensors are there to cover like extreme rain conditions, and they do a good job of that. But if you had for example, in New York, where the city could just get completely hit by a lot of snow, then the vehicles can struggle because they struggle to be able to detect the edges of the roads, other vehicles and things like that. So that's why you're not seeing it, you know, not rolling out so quickly in some of the other cities. But in places like China, though, for example, they're just plowing ahead. They just get this and they're just moving ahead, and they've moved ahead pretty aggressively on it. And now as Europeans, we're left with the choice that we don't have any technology that's really been developed in Europe, or very little, let's say, in terms of the brains of these self-driving cars. So what we're going to have to rely on at the moment is either the US or the China. And that's actually potentially an opportunity, and potentially an opportunity for Ireland, that we could create that driving stack.
And just my last question then is, when I am powering up the car, I'm going to do it. I'm bringing it to a place where I can do that. Would robot taxis be powered here? Because would they need to self-charge? Do they drive themselves to an EV powering station? Would it be solar? How do you see that happening?
Yeah, it's definitely electric. So it's definitely that. And a lot of companies are just looking at like sort of wireless charging pads. So the vehicle can just, you know, you're not relying on, say, someone having to physically take a cable and plug it into the vehicle. If you have wireless charging technology underneath the vehicle, it simply just has to drive over that charging spot, a bit like we do with our phones now. And then once it's charged, it goes back on the road again. But again, like that's just starting to ramp up those types of services.
Well, Russell, we've gone around the world and we've gone forwards and backwards in time. Thank you very much for joining me here on Taking Stock. Russell Vickers, co-founder and CEO of Future Mobility Campus Ireland. Now, for the answer to this week's trivia. At the beginning of the show, I asked you, where might I find the longest mountain range on Earth, 37 critical minerals, and the world's largest living structure? And the answer is in the ocean. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge is the longest mountain range on Earth, which is 65,000 kilometres long. And the Great Barrier Reef is the world's largest living structure, both of which, of course, are in the ocean. I was emceeing a conference for World Ocean Week on Wednesday, and I have to say it was a fascinating education. That's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do pop the link into your WhatsApp groups as well. Taking Stock is also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock this week was Simon Keane with Tessa Njonku and Stephen Daunt on research with Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.